is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and we have Northwest Indiana activist Ruth Needleman in studio with us as we have our occasional chats to find out what's happening here in the communities. Of interest here, and we know, of course, one of those I'm sure is going to have to be the immigration and naturalization staff and their hijinks, as some people call it, involving the Gary Chicago International Airport. Ruth, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. That was a polite way of referring to it. But let me just start with a little history, because yesterday, May 1st, was International Workers' Day. And it was been celebrated since 1886 in the first national strike ever organized in the United States, when workers went out nationwide for the 8-hour day. Now, you know, in steel, they work 7 days a week. They work 12 hours a day, except every other week they work 24. So an 8-hour day was a promise of a decent life. It's interesting because today people are still fighting for an 8-hour day, either because they work part-time temporary work and can't get that much work, or back in the steel mills, they're working 10 and 12 hours again. Mm-hmm. And so this was a very important moment. And the leaders of the struggle who helped to organize the strike, and then there was a meeting in Haymarket Square, now honored with a big monument to workers, where workers continued the battle for the 8-hour day, but somebody, nobody knows who, threw a bomb. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, four of the leaders of the workers' movement, who were not even at Haymarket Square at that time, were not only charged, but they were murdered. They were hung after an international campaign to save their lives. And throughout the world, the celebration of May Day is enormous, except for the country where it started, the United States, where we think we dance around the maypole, but that's not it. So yesterday for May Day, I went up to Chicago because there was going to be a march from Haymarket Square over to the ICE building on the Congress Parkway. And I hobbled over because I have my foot in a cast, 80-degree weather, the sweat pouring down my brow, to this demonstration. I got some good photos, and I posted them. It was a very lively, peaceful demonstration. And somebody sent me a video this morning showing everybody tear-gassed and running. So I don't know what happened. There was nothing in the Chicago Tribune. That surprised me. But anyhow, that's May Day. But back to deportations, ICE, and immigration. This Friday, we will once again be at the Gary Chicago Airport. This airport handles the deportations for all of the northern area of Indiana, the entire Chicago region, up to and including Milwaukee. Last week, three buses brought in immigrants from Kankakee who were deported. And this seems to be escalating. It used to be two buses, sometimes one bus, now three buses. And that's partially because this administration is rounding up everyone and anyone. I was at a demonstration last Friday out in Highland by the apartment buildings where immigration came to pick up one person, but somehow were equipped to carry away eight.
One thing I noticed here in regards to that, the little mini demonstration that was out there on there at 44th and Prairie.
I was there.
It was one of these demonstrations where a lot of people were out there, obviously, and with signs and talking and chanting as
and
well.
Raining.
And that's right, it was raining too. One of the things too that some of the media coverage also noted some things that you talk about often that haven't always been brought out, and you mentioned before in little history about all this, about the history, I guess, of Gary Chicago International Airport and their dealings with Chicago City Hall, why it seems that the Gary Airport seems to be the target of all of these flights. And you mentioned about the fact that that was one of the arrangements years ago.
In 1995, a pact was signed with Mayor Richard Daley and, I'm forgetting who was mayor of Gary at the time, Barnes. And in the pact, it specifically says that the Gary Airport's mission is to serve as a reliever to O'Hare and to Midway, which gives Chicago complete power over what happens at the Gary Airport. So, for example, a year ago, February, there was a meeting at the Gary Airport where they announced any day now we will have at least 6 passenger flights a day. And it's been a year and 2 months, and why haven't we seen those flights? Because Southwest wanted to move some flights to Gary, and Chicago put the kibosh on it and said, no, relieve means do the dirty work. It doesn't mean take passenger service, create jobs, and do good for Gary. And so we have an airport that has no passenger service. We're extending the runway and building a new customs building so that they can deport even further away. They can take people directly to Syria, directly to Central America. And it is unconscionable the way that the ICE people treat these immigrants. I might have mentioned the last time, I can't remember now, but there was a guy who served 2 tours in Afghanistan, and he got picked up on a minor drug charge, served his time in jail, came out, and was deported. He thought he was a citizen because they told him, you go into the army and you serve, you get a path to citizenship. But they never showed him the path. And so his mother has gone down to meet him over the border where he got deported. And he told her that the ICE agents were pushing him around, taking selfies and laughing at him. He has children here. He has family here. These people are cruel. They are not trained. They are not like community police. They are so much worse. And they come to the airport. And the city of Gary is a welcoming city, so we're not supposed to spend a penny doing the work of ICE or of the federal government. But they put out dozens, and I mean dozens, state police, county sheriff, Gary police, Hammond police, SWAT teams. They come fully armed for a group of people who are peacefully demonstrating. So this Friday, we will have a prayer vigil, and it will be led by people of faith. Pastor Charles Streitelmeyer will be the MC. He is from the church, the Augustana Lutheran Church in Hobart, where they defeated an immigrant prison. And many other pastors and ministers will be there, and we invite the public. The mayor has promised, she spoke to me directly, that they will not be wearing their SWAT uniforms. They will not be pushing us around. They will not be asking for identification. It will be peaceful, and they will not block our view. That'll be a difference. Although last week, what they did was send the buses an hour earlier so that people miss them. But we're on them, and we know it could be earlier. So come to the airport on Airport Road. Come at 10. And hopefully you won't miss the buses, although that could happen.
They could send them at 9 o'clock in the morning, too.
Well, they left at 9 a.m. last time.
Uh-huh.
So we're going to try to get out there earlier, although the announcement was for 10. And so support your neighbors. This is causing so many problems to families in Northwest Indiana. Picking up workers who are doing a job, paying taxes, taking them away from children and families when they have committed no other crime but escaping terror in their home countries. And we have now that big caravan of women and children mainly who have been escaping, particularly the brutality in Honduras, where gangs kill, rape, and also recruit. And so it's really important that we not be the hub for this kind of activity. But on a similar note, changing the subject, starting this Saturday, I don't know if you're familiar with the Paul Henry Gallery in Hammond.
Yes.
It's a fabulous place. But the show opening this week is called The Art of Resistance and Resilience in Northwest Indiana. So we have paintings, we have puppets. There's going to be a puppeteer there who's going to demonstrate the puppets. And we will have street theater. There will be musical bands. We have banners, posters, noisemakers from all the different struggles, from East Chicago's Calumet struggles to the airport to the GEO prison to the environmental struggles against the Petcoke and obviously against the BP tar sands. Mm-hmm. So come, it's from 5 to 9. So you've got a wide window and we've got lots of entertainment. And the address is 416 Sibley in Hammond. It will be fun. It will be educational. And it will be a community gathering. So you don't want to miss that. One other announcement.
Mm-hmm.
Can I squeeze it in?
Right.
Okay. On May 8th at the federal court in Hammond, the lawsuit that was filed against the city of Gary because it passed a welcoming city ordinance will be heard in court starting at 1:30. I believe it's in courtroom 5. And the people are claiming to have been injured by this welcoming city ordinance, but of course they can show no injury because no one has in any way so far been affected by it.
It'll be interesting to see if it's just a court hearing, just to hear arguments about the matter.
Well, there's two motions. Yeah. There's two motions. There is a motion to dismiss this lawsuit as not having any standing whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And then the people who filed it have filed for a quick judgment. But I don't think they have a case. It would be wonderful if people came out to support the city of Gary for passing this welcoming ordinance, and hopefully we'll also get the city of Gary to implement this ordinance and stop sending so many police to the airport.
Well, Ruth, it sounds like some great events happening here. If you're interested, and take advantage of the opportunities to check out what's going to happen in federal court, or at least stand outside the federal courthouse in Hammond and show your support out that way. They would appreciate that too.
That's right. But it would be good for people to go in and hear the nonsense that the lawsuit includes, but also the city of Gary has an exceptional team of lawyers from Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., who are flying in and with the ACLU are defending the city of Gary. It should be very educational.
Well, Ruth Needleman, thank you for the information. We appreciate you always coming by and giving us updates here. And certainly with this week's, prayer vigil, as you said, it's
going to
happen
vigil,
at the Gary
10
Chicago
o'clock
International
at the airport
yeah.
Friday morning.
That's right.
Don't be late, or
and
you might miss everything.
And then we've got the court hearing on the case involving City of Gary's welcoming city
and
in federal
court. And this fabulous art show.
That's right. So we want that there. A lot to consider for the weekend.
Hope to
see you all. Ruth Needleman, thank you very much, as always, for being with us today.
And thank you.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, and it's time once again for another edition of Green Fleet Radio. And here is Carl Lusick.
Well, welcome to another edition of Green Fleet Radio. Today, our guest is Mr. Jeff Benson. He's the Executive Director of the Dunes Learning Center. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Carl.
First, we need to congratulate you on the Dunes Learning Center winning the South Shore Clean Cities Nonprofit Organization of the Year Award at our annual meeting. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. It was wonderful to receive that. The 2017 Nonprofit
yes.
of the Year.
So tell our listeners, Jeff, what is the Dunes Learning Center and what does it do?
Dunes Learning Center is a residential environmental learning center located inside the national park in the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore. If you think of a summer camp that's open all year long with school groups coming during the school year and summer camps in the summer, that's sort of what we are like. We have 10 cabins that sleep mm-hmm. 80 people. We serve 25,000 meals a year.
That's amazing. That's an amazing number. And again, you know, just being a resident of Northwest Indiana, I just see you guys are involved with so many different things. There's an event going on constantly, and you know, seeing some of the underprivileged kids and just some of the different things that go on there. It's a wonderful facility, and you guys do some great things there. So, What about some of your history there, Jeff?
Well, the grounds that we're on was the old Camp Goodfellow, which started in 1941 by U.S. Steel, and it ran every summer from 1941 to 1976 when the National Park bought the land. And then it sat vacant for 20 years. And then later, Lee Botts, Mark Reschken, and Dale Enquist came up with an idea to have a residential environmental learning center there, much like Cuyahoga and in Yosemite and other places around in national parks. And they thought we should have one. And so they convinced Congressman Visklosky and Senator Lugar to get some money to do that, and they did.
That's
so
wonderful.
It opened in 1998.
Wow. And I know you just celebrated a big birthday.
Yeah, 20 years this year.
So. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And, you know, you don't look a day over 20, Jeff.
I'm not. As long as I'm looking this way.
That's wonderful. And so how do you move people around the park, Jeff?
So historically, what we've done is we've rented school buses from Gary, Indiana, for Illinois Central or other servers. And they drive out there, pick up our kids, and then drive them to Coles Bog because you're moving about 70 people at a time. Mm-hmm. And it's seems to me that that's a, kind of a silly way to do it, but it's the best we could. And a number of years ago, we got a Sarbanes grant from Congress for the park to get some propane-powered shuttle buses. Mm-hmm. And so they are each 16-passenger buses, and they work very well. They're propane-powered, so they don't pollute as much.
Absolutely.
And they live at our facility, so they're not having to commute from Gary to do this, so that we're reducing the diesel emissions and successfully moving people around. We sure could use a larger bus, though.
Well, hopefully we can help you with that. You're listening to Green Fleet Radio. Our guest today is Mr. Jeff Benson, Executive Director of the Dunes Learning Center. So, Jeff, as you talk about some of the green technology in your operations, what are you using for different types of green technology besides propane buses?
So a number of things we've done. One of the things we did as soon as I started 5 years ago to be the big cheese there, NIPSCO offers you to use sustainable or green power. Mm-hmm. You can select it on your bill. And so we started using 100% renewable electricity from offered by NIPSCO then. So we've done that. We also used on-demand water heaters for all the facilities.
Absolutely.
And so that we're not heating 40 gallons times 10 cabins when they're, you know, when we don't need 40 gallons. Mm-hmm. And so that was fueled by a grant. And that is a really good savings for gas.
Sure it is.
Mm-hmm. And then we've been able to get a CMAQ, which is Congestion Mitigation and Air Quality grant from NERPSE, which is the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission, with the help of South Shore Clean Cities, to get a propane fueling station for our shuttle buses. And so we're every way we can, we really try to reduce our carbon footprint.
And you're doing a great job. So what are some of the ways the public can experience Dunes Learning Center or get involved there, Jeff?
Well, they can volunteer. The National Lakeshore has a new volunteer website that is really wonderful, and we are working with them to get volunteers out. Mostly we're a closed campus, but there's three events throughout the year that the public can come see what we do. They can also come during volunteer days, but the three open houses are the winter open house, a summer camp open house, which happened in April, April 7th, and then Get Outdoors Day, which is our big one, which is June 9th from 11 to 3, and it's open to the public. Come and see what goes on there.
And so as you talk about people getting involved, how can they learn more about the Dunes Learning Center?
They can go to our website. Mm-hmm. That's a good place, which is duneslearningcenter.org. And our Facebook page, which is Dunes Learning Center, and follow us on Instagram and Twitter, Dunes Learning.
Sure. And as we come to the end of our program, Jeff, any closing thoughts to our listeners?
I think that the alternative fuels, the progress that is being made by cities like Hobart, by LaPorte, other cities that are doing this stuff, and nonprofits and the National Park using these alternative fuels, whether it's electric, propane, CNG, It's really good to see that we have these options for reducing our emissions.
Well, I know one thing, Jeff, is that we're both big believers in partnerships, and I think that's mm-hmm. how we've accomplished so much. That's mm-hmm. How you get things done is you look for all these partnerships. And again, I think for the future of Northwest Indiana, it's us actually working together. So I want to say to you, congratulations, because I think you're one of those folks that really know how to leverage these partnerships to actually get things done and improve the quality of life here in Northwest Indiana. So congratulations for that. And that will do it for today's edition of the Green Fleet Radio. Thanks again to Jeff Benson, the Executive Director of the Dunes Learning Center. Green Fleet Radio airs three times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities. And if you missed any of the comments today, you can check the podcast out on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, and catch them there. And they're also available, too, on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Members of Indiana's newly created Governor's Workforce Cabinet say that the state must focus educational messaging if it wants to create a more skilled workforce. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, the new cabinet met for the first time on Tuesday.
A mixture of government officials, business, and education leaders make up the 21-person cabinet. Chairman Danny Lopez says the cabinet must be results-driven to work.
The role and the charge of this cabinet is to take this from an academic exercise into an operationalized exercise.
Vincennes University President Chuck Johnson says state leaders must strengthen vocational education if it's to be recommended as an alternative to a traditional four-year degree.
How many of us in this room have a child that has gotten a certificate versus a degree, or that we are going to encourage them to go get an associate degree into a career path? So many of us think about this is something great for other people's kids, for the kids who aren't doing this, but how many of us are actively encouraging our own kids to look at these paths?
The cabinet is scheduled to meet every other month unless more meetings are determined to be necessary. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
On a recent edition of Lakeshore Focus on Lakeshore PBS, host Keith Kirkpatrick talked with Mitch Barloga from NERFC about what is called PED, pedal, and paddle. Here's Keith and his conversation.
When the winter retreats and the nice weather returns, it's time to find your walking shoes, dust off the bike, and uncover the boat. Northwest Indiana is a treasure trove of green and blue trails, paths, and byways for the ped, pedal, and paddle people. There is no one better to talk about this subject than my guest today. I have already bestowed upon him the titles Baron of Bicycles, Wizard of Waterways, and Prince of Paths. Most of us just know him as Mitch Barloga, who also is the Active Transportation Manager with the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. I always get that thrown off by that Northwestern. You guys are the only group that calls yourself Northwestern.
Throws me off too. But thanks, Keith.
The rest of us just Northwest Indiana, right?
Exactly.
So I was trying to, we were talking a little bit before about how long it's been. I think it's been about 4 years since had you on the show.
Yep.
I don't remember your beard being that gray. Mine probably wasn't either.
That's what life will do to you.
Well, I'm glad to have you on the show. And,
thanks.
And with the nicer weather coming and, it's time for people to start, I guess, biking, and you're kind of the, you have another title. What is that title?
What, Trails Are?
The Trails Are. That's right.
The unofficial one, right.
That didn't have the same alliteration as, the other ones that I came up with.
Those were wonderful. Thank you.
You like those?
Yeah, I need more for my LinkedIn page. That's great. Just keeps adding to the titles.
There we go. So you're in charge of really trying to deal with all the pedestrian, bicycle, and water kind of transportation. That's what they call it. What is it? Active what?
Active transportation.
So how do you define that?
Active transportation is simply those modes of transportation that you yourself power. Okay? Basically people power. So you're active and involved in the transportation of yourself, no matter what that might be. So basically non-motorized.
This probably doesn't count when your car doesn't work and you're having to push it though, right?
It counts. That's interesting. I'd have to go back to the books on that.
So you've been responsible for this for how many years?
I've worked at NERPC regarding this matter for the last 14 years. And before that, I was working with the city of Crown Point on the same issue, and then in the south suburbs of Chicago for a couple years. So nearly 20 years.
So 14 years ago, What did we have in terms of paths and bicycles and waterways for Northwest Indiana?
What we had was a very disjointed network of systems. I can't remember the actual number exactly, but it's probably about 40 to 50 miles of trail, but they weren't connected. I mean, you couldn't get from A to B very well. You'd have to have a segment here, a segment there, maybe a few miles here, a few miles there. Waterways, those weren't developed at all. People knew where to paddle, but they didn't have signage, there wasn't any maps and what have you, and now we have been able to take that on quite well over the last decade or so.
14 years ago, I think if you would have asked the average person if we had bike trails and waterways in Northwest Indiana, the vast, vast majority would have probably said, no, we don't have anything like that here. Wouldn't you think?
It depends on where you lived. I mean, Hammond had some, obviously, the Erie Lackawanna, which is now a complete 17-mile system. It was sporadic, and the Prairie Duneland was sporadic in Portage, and Oak Savannah, and on and on. So it depends on where you lived, but I think the balance of the people maybe knew we had them, but they didn't know where to get on them.
Have you figured this out? If you get on one of the bike paths mm-hmm. and you just rode continuously, try to not get off a path, how many miles could you go on that? Do you know?
The longest contiguous path you can ride at this time is if you start in downtown Hammond. Actually, it's kind of a cross. You can start in downtown Hammond, or you can actually start just north of River Oaks. And both of those trails, Pensee and the Erie Lackawanna, will continue you through to the Oak Savannah Trail. That'll take you to Hobart. And then eventually you'll get to Portage on the Prairie Duneland to Chesterton. You can take that through Porter and then end up on the Calumet Trail. You could be there at the entrance of the State Park of the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, and that's probably a 40 to 50 mile contiguous path.
Wow.
Yeah.
Have you ever done that?
Once. Yes.
What's your favorite place to bicycle?
In this region, I would have to say it's the Oak Savannah Trail, Griffith to Hobart. It's a 9 to 10 mile system, but it's all canopied. It's all in shade. And the way the railroads worked in the day when they installed these corridors, they didn't care about environmental laws. They didn't have any environmental laws. So you had a wetland, you just built on it. And you know about train technology, you can't be sloped too much with a train. You have to stay within 1 to 2%. So the grade goes well above these wetlands, right through the Hobart Marsh area. I mean, environmentalists today would be appalled by it, but back then it's what you did. And now you have this fascinating trail network where you go through the treetops in many of the cases because you're so elevated. And then you get into Lake George and you have a vista. You can look over the entire Lake George area from the trail. And there is nature abundant, and again, trees abundant, and just a lot of fascinating stops along the way with that entire system.
So for people who are a little concerned about riding and thinking they imagine pedaling hard uphill or downhill, most of these paths are fairly flat because they're where the old railroads
are. They're the old railroads, and of course, the way the geology works out with the glacial wash, we're a very flat region.
So you can pretty much get around without killing yourself pedaling, right?
A lot of people like hills, by the way. That helps them train, but for the casual rider and the family riders, this is perfect.
Who came up with this pedal and paddle?
I guess that's my deal. There was an organization in Chicago called CATS, Chicago Area Transportation Study, and they merged into a larger organization. They put out a plan called Soles and Spokes. I thought, that's cute. Let's think of something for our end, and ped and pedal came up. And then when Dan Plath kind of exploded with his work in Northwest Indiana, Paddling Association, paddle came into the view, and that just all meshed together with ped, pedal, and paddle. So that's where we're at.
The logo is cool, too, because it just kind of shows the bike and the whole thing. So it's kind of a...
Well, that's John Smith. That's our creative artist in-house. So all kudos to him.
It's neat. So what did bring about all this with the waterways becoming part of the mix?
Yeah, back in 2007, we were putting together this unique planning effort called Greenways and Blueways. It was an effort to...
Which is another clever thing.
Thank you.
Did you come up with all these?
I think somebody else may have come up with Greenways and Blueways. Okay. It could have been a collaborative effort. I won't take all the credit there. But it was an idea of bringing together all of the conservation planning that we had worked on at NERPSI for many years, coalescing it, as well as water trail, planning. We had never done that before. We had never identified all the potential water trails in this region. We have a region that is somewhat wet, okay? It floods a lot. There's a lot of corridors, ditches, rivers, lakes, call them what you will. And people have been paddling them for a long time, but we wanted to make sure people understood, okay, where were the put-ins and the takeouts? And the best thing about water trails, Keith, as you would imagine, it's all there. You just have to get to it.
Okay? Why do they call them water trails?
Well, people have referred to that for a while. You know, you canoe, you kayak, and you float down them like you ride on a trail. So it just kind of made sense. It's a water trail like a land trail is.
I will often tell people, when you are flying back in from the east or almost any place and you're taking that approach into Chicago, you kind of have this corridor over northwest Indiana.
Yes.
And if you're on a sunny day, if you've got the window seat and you look down, it's remarkable how much water there is down here.
Yes.
With all the wetlands and the streams, and I don't think we see that.
No. We don't.
Because they're really hidden.
As they say, they're incised. They're deeply incised, you know, below the grade. And so you have to, and that's the problem with getting down to these streams, is that you have to have the right ramp and the approach down to the waterways. So obviously they have to be somewhat safe and in some cases even accessible for the disabled to get to those waterways. And then, of course, you have to have enough of those launches where people can put in one area, take out at another area so they're not stuck. And that takes a bit of planning. And, of course, in between it all, you have log jams and you have other types of obstructions. And all that goes into the planning.
I guess you never think about that because once you're on a bicycle, you're just kind of riding along. And if you have to stop someplace, you can literally chain it to a tree or something. But with a boat, I mean, you got something bigger.
Right.
You probably have a trailer or a bigger vehicle to carry it. And now
yes.
You got to try to get it down the bank into mm-hmm. water. It is a lot more complicated.
It's complicated, and it can be quite the effort if you don't have the right ramp.
So huge improvements have been made in that access piece. Is that what's
yes.
really made the improvement?
We've had a lot of great improvements. Again, I mentioned Dan Plath with the Paddling Association. It's a phenomenal group of people. They're very active. There's a lot of stewardship going on there. Thanks to their work, we have a national water trail along Lake Michigan as well as the Kankakee River. Those are national designations. And they have just recently worked with the National Lakeshore in cleaning up the east branch of the Little Calumet River from the Portage area pretty much all the way to Chesterton. It's several miles. It's been cleaned out. It is a wonderful ride. It is one of the more natural areas, too, in this region. And that's a problem. You know, we have all these ditches. And they're great for water flow, but they're not much for, you know, paddling. You just kind of fly on through there. The ones that meander, those are attractive, but they're a problem. Those are the ones that you have your log jams because of all the meandering and the oxbowing from the lakes and what have you. And so they were able to get down there to the Little Cal. They were able to work with the National Lakeshore, and there was permits galore, as you would imagine, to make this work. But over the last couple of years, they have been able to clean it out, and now we have a functional waterway on that segment of the Little Cal.
Again, a different problem when a tree falls on a bike path. You just got to cut a section of it out.
Or you lift your bike up, yeah, right.
Or just go over it. But if it's in the water,
yeah.
You got to get it up the bank, and it's usually probably multiple pieces, and then everything starts sticking to it. And
I'll relay a real quick story. But we tried to paddle Deep River when we first did this plan back in 07 and 06, and it was... I put in with the study buddy that I was working with, Durs Anderson from the Open Lands group, and we started paddling. We thought we could do maybe 4 miles, and we didn't go more than 2 miles. It took us 6 hours to go 2 miles. We had to take that canoe out about 40 times, and we had another 40 near misses as well. Spiders this big looking at you going, what are you doing here? I mean... But the problem with that was every time we took the boat out, you know, there was... high banks. It was very difficult to get the canoe above there. Stinging nettle, just for one thing. I'm a grown man, and this was 10 years ago, and I was practically crying in a field of stinging nettle in the middle of this, wondering when this is going to end. I mean, I guess it was my coming of age moment. But...
Well, you're right, because once you're into it, it's not like, well, we'll just turn around and go back.
Yeah,
because...
you're just going to go back to all those log jams,
yeah,
right? I got to keep going.
To the same thing. So... Were you saying that to the spiders, what are you doing here, or were they saying that to you?
They had that look in their eye.
Yeah, they probably just thought you were just something, a big lunch, perhaps, you know?
They were probably communicating with their friends.
You know, as you were talking about the waterways, just, you know, we have these flood problems here. Mm-hmm. What happens when it floods? Do they tell people you can't go in to the rivers and areas during the flood period?
Yeah, people that are savvy with canoeing and do this often understand about flow. And there are a lot of river watches and river warnings. You get that on your phone. You see a flood warning, and it's pretty much telling you stay away from these. You don't want to paddle them. You're going to be taken down the stream at a high velocity. You might even crash into a bridge. You just don't want to do it. So I think there's a lot of common sense involved with that. The other end of the spectrum.
You can't also tell where the water is.
Well, that too.
It's like snow in the winter, right? And you can't see where the fire hydrants are.
You can't. And you can't even tell where to put the canoe in. You don't know where the ramps are. Everything's been flooded over. But the real problem is, conversely, when there's not enough water. And we have to work with making sure that people understand that some of our waterways are seasonal. And, you know, come the fall when things start drying up and, you know, before the snow really hits, we lose some waterways, and we have to keep people educated on that regard.
So how about the walking piece of this? Because mm-hmm. it seems like communities throughout our entire region have been putting in more sidewalks mm-hmm. and curbing and just walking paths, trying to make more places for people to walk.
Right.
What kind of progress are you making there?
We've been making quite a bit of progress in educating. Educating is always a big issue, but we also want to work with low-hanging fruit, children walking and biking to school, walking to school policies for all the school districts in our region. Just a smattering of them at this time are doing walk-to-school days or walking school buses where you get a whole bunch of kids together with a parent and you walk in. And it does a community a great service by taking on these events because you can find out where the gaps are in the infrastructure network as you're walking along. You're right there, you're like, why hasn't the sidewalk been finished? Why is that heaved up? There's no crosswalk to get to the school safely, and on and on and on. And so that's a great way to get kids acclimated. And of course, it gives them a start on some lifelong healthy habits. Now, for the rest of the community itself, you know, this is where you're going back into new subdivisions, making sure that not only do they provide sidewalks within, but also outside, so they're connecting to other places nearby, trails that connect to different neighborhoods as well. So it's a holistic system, and it really kind of comes down to how a community develops from a complete streets perspective, setting it up at the policy level, and then kind of filtering it down to the decision making.
Well, walking in the streets doesn't look like a particularly good idea
No.
at the speed some people drive through No. our streets.
Right.
I know I've seen you do that presentation, and I think it's such an interesting fact that if you get hit and the car is going less than 30 miles an hour, your chances of survival are 80%?
Yeah.
Is that the way it is?
About 80,
But
yeah.
Over 30, you got about 80% chance of being killed.
It's actually around 40 miles an hour that you have an 80, probably to 90% chance of being killed. I mean, that's the difference, and that's why you see the slower speed limits in the neighborhoods, especially around schools. You just never know.
Which people don't abide by a lot of
times. No, they don't abide by it. But here's an interesting fact, too, about schools. You know, you're trying to get children to school safely, but unfortunately people are driving them to school. 20% of all morning traffic are simply mom and dad dropping their child off to school. It's outstanding, that statistic. And again, low-hanging fruit. If you could just get more kids to walk that half mile or less to school, their nearby school, you could eliminate a lot of traffic and a lot of problems safety-wise for them.
I know you're trying to get some bike paths and walking paths and through the center of Merrillville,
yeah.
through the mall area, through that huge commercial area.
Yeah.
You know, how is that really going to happen? I've seen people try to cross those 10 lanes of traffic across Route 30?
Yeah, about 10.
Plus you're having to walk across all the parking lots and all the side roads.
Mm-hmm.
How's that going to work? Are you going to go under, over, through?
We put out a plan last year, a plan that we worked with the town of Merrillville, the city of Hobart, called the I-65 US 30 corridor study. And we looked at just that issue about how people can get around their bicycle and pedestrian wise. We were able to work with a firm out of Chicago. 12 miles of new trail have been proposed in this particular area. And it goes under I-65, it goes over I-65, it goes over US 30 with new bridges. Now that's obviously a long-term issue, but getting bike and ped safely into that district is a big deal because you're right, people do walk in there. There's a lot of people who are employed within the South Lake Mall area that don't have access to cars. They come in by bus, they come in otherwise, they're walking along 30. You see that all the time. You see what we call desire paths there, where people are making, you know, these dirt ruts in the road. And the need is there. And so we have kind of cracked that egg, so to speak, with the trail, the CNO Greenway, coming in from downtown Merivale, coming under I-65 and stopping at Mississippi Boulevard now. And we're hoping to work that around where the Toys R Us and the Walmart is, eventually to the Colorado Avenue corridor and continuing on to Winfield. And then some work within that development as well to make sure we can provide for safe access.
So another interesting challenge on some of those streets, some of those roads which barely can accommodate two cars, and there's no shoulder at all, so
yes.
And we got ditches there.
Yep.
But what a novel idea to maybe leave Best Buy and walk across the street to Target rather than, it would be good for all of us, instead of keep moving your car every few hundred feet to the next store.
Well, true. And that really stands for anything. I mean, if you can make things attractive and safe, people are simply going to use it more often.
How connected are we to, there's some great paths over in Chicago and mm-hmm. Illinois. We're now fairly well connected to those?
That's a great question, because we have established two state line connections right now, the Pennsy Greenway, which crosses from Munster into Lansing, and then up in Hammond at 112th that goes right in the South Chicago from the Wolf Lake vicinity. We will be opening up a new trail later this year from where the Horseshoe Casino is right to the state line where the old generating plant was by Calumet Park. We're trying to work with the city of Chicago to make sure that they can connect to that end of it, because we're kind of leaving it there at an access road, and that'll bring people safely into the park.
We're doing what Illinois did before, was bring those paths up to Indiana, and we didn't connect to them.
And now we're kind of, you know, returning the favor. There is a gap that has been a bit of an issue in the village of Burnham that we're trying to work with NCTE that runs through there, as well as some other railroad stakeholders. And if we can get through that obstacle right now and kind of wind the trail through there, and it's a complicated system, you're talking about a couple of bridges and some other pathways, we'll be able to make that connection from Chicago to the balance of our region and make that the safe connection people have been waiting for years. Very close.
So we're down here to the end. What is the one message that you want to get out to the general public about walking, biking, boating, all these things? What do you want them to know?
It provides the health benefits you're looking for. It provides the economic benefits you desire as well. The more people that can walk and bike to their destinations, they're helping their own bodies, they're helping their own pocketbooks, they're not putting money into automobiles, and they're helping their environment as well. I mean, one of the most noxious uses that we have in this country is automobile use, coming right out of the tailpipe, okay? I even talked to a representative of South Shore Clean Cities about the idea of, I know you're trying to do alternate fuels and you're trying to do electric cars and that's all great, but bicycle and pedestrian, hey, that's the original clean fuel. And so if you take a look at the holistic benefits of bicycle and walking, and of course paddling, because paddling is a great way of getting anybody, including children, an appreciation of nature, because you're off the grid down there. You're in this environmental corridor, you're within an urban area, and you're like, this is wonderful.
Well, I appreciate that very professional answer, because I've also seen you say, get out of your car and start walking or pedaling. And sometimes you got to say that.
Sometimes you have to have an incentive, right?
So thanks for being the huge advocate you are for this, and the guy who stuck with it so long, because you've really made a difference in our region, and I think people appreciate it.
I appreciate that, Keith. Thank you.
Thanks for being here.
Lakeshore Focus airs on Friday nights at 7:30, and it's rebroadcast on Sunday mornings at 9:30 on Lakeshore PBS. This is Regionally Speaking. Three Republican Party candidates are jockeying for a chance to unseat Democratic incumbent Senator Joe Donnelly this year. Luke Messer joined that race after serving in Congress since 2013, and within a few years as well, spent at the State House on his resume before that. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith sat down and talked with Messer about the issues in the bruising Republican Party primary campaign.
I want to jump right in. The topic lately that's mattered a lot to a lot of Hoosiers, particularly Hoosier farmers, is this issue of tariffs and a potential trade war.
Yeah.
What do you say to Hoosier farmers about how they're going to deal with what President Trump is doing?
Well, listen, first, the Hoosier farmers I talk to appreciate President Trump's leadership, and they understand that we've been in a trade war with China for some time. China has been at war with us. They steal our intellectual property. They treat our products unfairly. They manipulate their currency. And so Hoosier farmers appreciate the president's leadership. They are, of course, understandably worried about some of China's threats of bullying our agricultural products. And so the details of how we roll this out over time will be important. But I trust the president to implement it in a way that's good for Hoosier farmers.
Speaking of the president, obviously you and Mr. Rokita and Mr. Braun are all doing your best to align yourselves with President Trump to say, you know, if you want somebody who supports President Trump, send me to the Senate. Are you worried about tying yourself so closely to someone who can be so unpredictable?
The vast majority of Hoosiers support this president's policies. And I can tell you, as I travel the state, people appreciate this president's policies. They feel like he's under fire unfairly much from the national media. And they care, frankly, a whole lot more about the substance of this president's policies than they do the style of his tweets.
Perhaps the most the signature achievement so far of the Trump administration has been the federal tax bill. Are you worried that the average Hoosier won't be seeing enough in their paycheck that they're going to hold you accountable for
Frankly,
that?
Frankly, I think that's just out of step with what I hear when I talk to working Hoosiers. I mean, folks are seeing pay raises because the economy is going better and there's more competition for workers. Lots of folks have seen bonuses because their employers now have money to provide those bonuses. Folks are starting to see more money in their paycheck because the withholdings, even though the tax cuts don't fully take effect until next year, the withholdings are bringing, you know, dollars into people's paychecks. That's what people care about. Listen, most Hoosiers are focused on their own life. They're not worried about all that politics of envy that some on the left are trying to describe.
You've campaigned talking about deficits and how the burden we're placing on future generations is going to be crushing. And yet the federal tax bill would add significantly to the deficit over time. Why are those two things compatible in your mind?
I just don't believe those. The same actuaries that made the analysis you described said that the deficit would go down under Obamacare. That didn't happen.
Much has been made about your residency. You spend a lot of time living in Virginia with your family because, as you've said repeatedly, your kids deserve a full-time dad. Are you worried that you simply don't have enough time to devote to being a U.S. senator?
The only time I hear that concern is when it's raised by folks that are trying to run against me in this primary campaign. I have hustled and worked hard over the last 6 years in a 19-county district making sure that we're present. I'm a lifetime Hoosier and somebody that also loves my kids and believes my kids need a full-time dad. And I am confident that I can serve this state of Indiana and also look out for my family, as Dan Coats did, as Dan Quayle did, as Mike Pence did, and as I have over the course of the last 6 years in Congress.
This has been a bruising primary from all sides. Whoever wins, are you confident the party is going to be able to rally around the candidate?
Well, I'm confident the party is going to be able to run rally around the candidate because I believe I'm going to be that candidate. And I sincerely believe when we get through this, because we've conducted our campaign with integrity, because we've been honest and stayed focused on the truth, we're going to be in a strong position.
Thanks so much for sitting down with me.
Great.
Appreciate
Thanks.
It.
Yeah.
Tomorrow, we'll complete the series of three conversations with the GOP U.S. Senate candidates with Todd Rokita. U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams issued an advisory last month. More people, he says, should carry naloxone, the opioid overdose antidote. According to reports, Washington, D.C. area and all states have laws that would increase the access to this life-saving drug, but it's hard to get it out to the people who need it the most. Jake Harper with Side Effects Public Media has a story.
About 4 months ago, Courtney Sturgeon was driving in Indianapolis.
So I was coming back from a morning appointment that I was about a week early for.
So you weren't even supposed to be there?
I wasn't supposed to be there.
She saw a car on the side of the road and some people surrounding it. She asked if she could help.
And the guy said, "No, ma'am, it's an overdose, heroin, they're dead." And I kind of recall saying, "No, man, I've got Narcan," which sounds silly, but I'm pretty certain that's what came out.
Narcan is a brand name naloxone spray. And Sturgeon works for Overdose Lifeline, a nonprofit that distributes naloxone and trains people how to use it. That's why she had it with her. She sprayed it up the driver's nose and waited for paramedics to show up.
And as they were walking towards us, the driver started slowly moving.
Both the driver and the passenger survived. The Surgeon General wants more people to carry naloxone so they can act before first responders arrive. That can include people who use drugs or their friends and family. But it can be hard to get. Naloxone is a prescription drug. Normally, a doctor or nurse would have to prescribe it. Justin Phillips says that can be a barrier.
That means I have to go to my doctor and say, "I have an opioid use disorder and I want to save my life." not going to happen, right?
Philip started Overdose Lifeline, and this issue is personal.
My 20-year-old son Aaron overdosed on heroin in October of 2013 and passed away. I didn't know there was such a drug as naloxone.
Phillips worked to get a law passed in 2015 called Aaron's Law. Now you can get a naloxone prescription if you know someone at risk of an overdose. And in 2016, Jerome Adams was Indiana's health commissioner. He signed an order that lets anyone walk into a participating pharmacy and buy naloxone. But Phillips says there are still problems.
I don't know that enough people are aware still to this day.
That can include pharmacists, she says.
And there's still going to be the barrier of going into the pharmacy and having to acknowledge.
The stigma.
Exactly.
A lot of people just don't want to admit they use drugs or know someone who does. And they might be shocked by naloxone's price.
And I was just wondering if you guys carry it, and if so, like how much it costs.
We do carry it.
$95 for two doses of Narcan at a drugstore in Indianapolis. Across the street, $80 for the generic.
People that are users are scraping together just enough money to buy drugs. I mean, they're not preparing to buy naloxone with that money, right?
Brad Ray is a researcher at Indiana University's School of Public and Environmental Affairs. He says this is where third-party distributors can come in. Indiana has used federal and state funds to purchase naloxone, but county health departments distribute those free doses. Most go to first responders. Nearly half of Indiana's counties don't participate. The ones that do, Ray says, have to work hard to get naloxone to the right people.
Some counties have really incredible community outreach teams. Like when that started a syringe exchange, they had like, you know, within a couple of years, they had hundreds of clients.
But Indiana currently only has 8 syringe exchanges. Corey Davis is an attorney with the National Health Law Program, a D.C. organization that advocates for the underserved. He says the federal government could help eliminate some of these barriers by making naloxone over-the-counter.
The FDA commissioner has the authority to move a medication over-the-counter if it's not in the public interest for it to be a prescription.
That would make naloxone easier to get, he says, and could even drive the price down.
It could happen quickly, and they're not even considering that. It's frustrating.
Meanwhile, 16 U.S. senators have called on Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar to negotiate lower prices with naloxone manufacturers. Jake Harper, Side Effects Public Media.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. And tomorrow, of course, is Reporters Roundtable Thursday. And we'll check with some of the reporters about the stories that they have covered online and in print. They include Dan Carton from the Times of Northwest Indiana. Hope you'll join us.